Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, and many would-be and will-be voters are confused. Rules and regulations seem to change every other week, and how that plays out at the polls probably will be studied in the years to come. Donald Trump has warned without proof of fraud and a rigged election and directed his followers to watch for cheating. We'll talk about how the election is supposed to work today. Joining us, election specialist at the League of Women Voters of Ohio, Peg Rosenfield. Welcome back, Peg.
Thank you.
Also from the Ohio Voter Rights Coalition, a nonprofit organization focused on ensuring free, fair, and accessible elections, Camille Wimbush. Welcome, Camille.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us as well, Ohio State professor and director of the Election Law Center at the OSU Moritz College of Law and author of a new book. It's called Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States, Ned Foley. Welcome back, Ned.
Great to see you, Ann.
All right. So, Ned, just to kick it off, how often are elections rigged, or how much is cheating a problem in the United States when it comes to voting?
Extremely rare, sort of exceedingly rare, and much rarer than it used to be. If you go back to the 19th century, it happened with more frequency. I think it's also important to figure out what exactly the term rigged means or what we might mean by that. When you hear a candidate say the system is inherently rigged, so you can't trust the count no matter what, that's never been the case in America. The only time in the past that we've had to even be concerned is when you have extremely close elections. And usually the concern is not stealing. It's more administrative errors that complicate the counting of the ballots. So the idea that there's a willful manipulation of the election to achieve a different result than what the voters wanted, again, extraordinarily rare. Now, there have been some elections in American history where ballot box stuffing, old-fashioned ballot box stuffing, did make a difference. But you have to go back to 1948, for example, to think of a statewide race of significance of that kind.
And Peg Rosenfield, this idea, what's the – generally from your years with the League of Women Voters, is this year different? Are people more worried than other years, or has this been coming on maybe since 2000 and the hanging shads debacle in Florida?
Oh, I think that's definitely when it started. But this year, it's ramped up, I think, because the partisans on both sides feel so strongly. And in every election, when you lose, you can't believe you lost. It must be something wrong because, well, you just worked so hard, you should have won. And I've worked on campaigns years ago, and if you lost, you knew something had to be wrong or you'd have won. And that's what we're hearing this year, I think.
A lot depends on the candidates accepting the outcome.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I worked on a campaign where we defeated an incumbent, and the incumbent was running the automatic recount. And we were definitely paranoid, but we won because the system really does work to get you a fair count. It really does. There's so many protections built in.
We're talking about voting in 2016. If you have a question or comment about voting, I know a lot of you did on Monday when I had my reporters roundtable. Now we have some experts in the room that can tell you about what you should know about voting in 2016, whether you're going to be an early voter, an absentee voter, however you're going to do it, voting in person. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Camille Wimbush, tell us about what your organization does and what you've experienced this election cycle.
So the Ohio Voter Rights Coalition is a network of nonpartisan voter advocates who are out there, you know, monitoring Ohio's elections day in and day out. This year, we are running an election protection hotline in connection with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. It's a national hotline. Anyone can call and get their voting questions answered. We also have a service where if people experience problems or feel that something just wasn't right about their voting experience, they can call into that hotline.
On voting day?
Oh, they can call. Early voting
anytime.
Is already happening
okay,
now.
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
You know, we're getting calls at the hotline. That hotline number is 866-OUR-VOTE. And what we do is we have lawyers who are there to be able to take those problems and work with elections officials to get those resolved.
You told me before we went on the air that it's live in Ohio, that this is that real people will pick up the phone. It won't be an answering machine. Is
yes.
that a distinction compared to other states? In some states, it won't be live.
So a lot of states have basically you would call on the hotline and, you know, if it's Florida or Texas or California, you would press a certain button and someone in D.C. would answer it.
Okay.
Which is helpful. But we also like to provide an extra level of service for people who are in Ohio. And we've been doing this work for a number of years, a number of election cycles. And so a lot of times it's just easier to give that instant information to people. And so, yeah, we had someone called and said, is this a robot? No, we're actual live people who are there to give you instant service.
And of course, we'll have that posted on the link in a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I want to start, if we can, with the most recent election litigation to clear up, because it's going to be in the news. The Ohio Democratic Party and two other groups representing the homeless asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene in a dispute over absentee and provisional ballot laws. The law allows county election boards to throw out absentee and provisional ballots for minor flaws. This stems from a 2014 law that requires Ohioans to accurately complete 5 fields of information on request for absentee to your provisional ballots. Why were the provisions put in place just 2 years ago? You know, Ned Foley, are you familiar with this issue?
A little bit, yeah. We've had litigation over provisional ballots in Ohio ever since we've had provisional ballots. In 2004, that was the first election after the so-called Help America Vote Act that Congress passed that mandated that all states have provisional ballots. And we had litigation then and ever since, which is unfortunate. The good news about provisional ballots, though, is they are a safety net. If you get that, if you're a voter and you think you're eligible, you should never be turned away from the polls without the ability to cast a provisional ballot, because that's your chance to record your preference. The federal law, which supersedes Ohio law, requires that the poll workers give you a provisional ballot so you can cast your vote. Now, it's provisional status means there may be questions about it, but if you're entitled to have it counted, there are enough lawyers in the state and they care about these in close elections, they'll figure out a way to count that ballot if it deserves to be counted. So this latest round of litigation is over some of the technical details about when you count them and when you don't. And whatever happens in the U.S. Supreme Court, what I would say to the average voter is make sure you cast that ballot. That at least gets it in place, and then we can worry about counting it afterwards if necessary.
Secretary of State John Husted has said this is an 11th-hour attempt to inject chaos into Ohio's election. The group says that this process disenfranchises voters. What about that, Peg Rosenfield?
Well, the problem is that some counties evidently don't count a ballot if there's a line where you have to print your name mm-hmm. and then you have to sign it. Well, if you signed on the top line and printed on the second line, that's a technical error and they won't count your ballot.
Uh-huh.
That's the kind of thing that this lawsuit's over. Or if you put today's date instead of your birth date, which is a very common error, if what they're saying is if the board can identify you and know who you are and where you live, they should count your ballot. And my objection is not to the lawsuit, but why do they keep passing these laws that are so restrictive?
Well, and also that can be interpreted differently county to county to county in Ohio.
And they're restricting the vote and don't do that. This is making sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's can keep you from voting. That's why we keep telling people, make sure you fill that form out absolutely correctly. And then they tried to put a thing in the law, and I don't even remember whether it finally got in, that the poll workers couldn't help you. Well, that's what they're there for.
They escort you to the polling booth.
But they couldn't help you fill out this form to make sure it's correct and say, oh, wait a minute.
Is that still in the law?
Well, that's one of the problems is that the laws are changing so quickly. It's almost impossible for someone like me who keeps up with it not to be able to keep up with it.
Right, right. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Camille Wimbush, what kinds of – are those the kind of questions you're getting?
So we occasionally do get people who have heard about a lawsuit and want to know what they should do. And, of course, we do tell them what Ned said, which is if there's any question, particularly we run into people who, you know, they want to check their registration. We find out that they have been purged. And they want to know what they should do. So we're just telling them to go to the early vote center. Right now, it's a really great opportunity because they've got election officials who are staffing that, and there's lots of them, and it's not so chaotic of a time. Mm-hmm. And so they have that time to make sure that they fill out that provisional ballot correctly. But we are definitely getting people who are wondering about where their absentee ballot is. They have an absentee ballot tracker that it's available for every county. If you go to myohiovote.com and you're concerned about where your ballot is, you should be able to look up your information and see where it is in the process. And if for some reason you don't have it, you can contact the board now. It's not too late to vote by mail if that's what you want to do. And we're getting just general questions, really, just, you know, where's my polling place? A lot of these polling locations have changed.
Yeah.
And in a major election, we get people who are infrequent voters and, you know, maybe their polling location changed in 2014 and they didn't vote in 2014 and they didn't get a reminder this year. And so that's why it's really great that people are checking their information, not waiting to the last minute, checking it and making sure they get all the information they need to vote.
I remember in 2000, I had a new polling place because I had moved and I thought it was at one school, but it was at another. And I remember, of course, 2000 was even in suburbs, big long lines, and waited in line for about 2 hours. And luckily, I could just say, oh, well, I'll go to the next polling place. And I had that kind of, you know, luxury. A lot of people don't.
Right.
The early voting's working out in Ohio?
Early voting is doing pretty well in Ohio. I think the numbers are up, and that's encouraging. In 2012, around a third of the population is voting early, and we hope that people continue to do that, use that trend. I just think it makes it smoother. For anyone who's concerned about, you know, this so-called, you know, intimidation that may happen at the polls or, you know, anything that may not be quite right with their voter registration being current, you know, now is a quiet, calm, orderly time to sort of get your information together, find out what you need to vote, go to the early vote center. They're starting weekend hours. This is the first weekend coming up. They will have weekend hours on Saturday. The boards of elections in every county will be open from 8 to 4. And on Sunday, they'll be open from 1 to 5. So if you can't get down there during regular business hours this weekend and the following weekend, they will be open.
I voted already in Franklin County, and I was really impressed with how efficient. They're busy. They're really busy.
People seem to be enjoying themselves, too.
But they were really efficient. They were right there to tell you where to go and go over here and then over there. And there was parking. It was full, but you could park. And they had the people with their sample ballots back away where they were supposed to be. I was really impressed.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with questions. If you do have a question, once again, 614-292-8513 about voting. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or you could check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Slavery is rooted in the history of the American presidency. 10 of the first 15 U.S. presidents enslaved humans. We learn about their stories and the significance of those narratives today. That's coming up Friday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Election litigation is never ending in Ohio, and this year is no different. Just yesterday, the Ohio Democratic Party and two groups representing the homeless asked the U.S. Supreme Court to stop a state regulation that would toss out absentee and provisional ballots for minor flaws, even if the election official can identify the voter. This is just one of many questions that voters have this election cycle. Still with us is elections specialist at the League of Women Voters of Ohio, Peg Rosenfield. Also, Election Administration Director for the Ohio Voter Rights Coalition, Camille Wimbush, and Director of the Election Law Center at the OSU Moritz College of Law, Ned Foley. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. I think it's really sad the way the system is set up to some degree, particularly in Ohio, which is a Republican Congress, a Republican governor, and Houston, the Republican.
Uh-huh.
And I see so much across the country, like Florida and some other areas, where there are Republicans in charge trying to set up laws.
Bob, it is very difficult. Bob, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's very difficult to understand you. Are you moving around a lot?
I think it might be my phone. Hang on a minute.
Okay.
Better?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry.
Crazy better.
I was on speaker, yeah.
Okay.
I'm just concerned about the fact when you have, you know, certain parties in power in the state, particularly, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that, but when the Republicans are in charge, like in Ohio, it seems like in Florida and some other states, they set up these laws that really make it difficult to vote, like some of the things your guest was talking about.
Well, it's
just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, that voting is a right, and the Constitution provides for that. And I don't understand why they're allowed to make up some of these crazy laws.
Well, it's because people elect them to office to do it.
That's what I'm saying. These people that are elected to office, mm-hmm. and the voters don't. And, you know, if you have these people in there. The people who get disenfranchised the most are the poor and some of the elderly and other things. They can't follow these extensive rules that they have that they keep changing all the time. I think that's this is totally unfair, and it really is frustrating, you know?
Okay. Well, Bob, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Camille Wimbush, I mean, what about that? I mean, are lower income, poor people, homeless people, people often in transition, are they disproportionately affected by this?
I think that's true. I think what we've seen in Ohio for the last several years is a concerted effort to chip away at some of the voting rights and restrict voting access through a number of pieces of legislation that have unfairly impacted people of color, low-income people, trying to make it harder for students to vote, et cetera. And so that's why organizations such as the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and the ACLU and a number of plaintiffs who've been fighting these voting rights we've been saying it, you know, this is going to disenfranchise people, and the legislature goes ahead and passes it anyway. So our only solution is to kick out the people who are passing these laws.
Ned Foley, Bob mentioned Republicans. I mean, Republicans have been in control of the legislature for so long now. They're passing all the laws. But is there a pattern when it comes to political parties and voter restrictions?
There is, but the rules are different in different states.
Right.
And although it is true that partisan legislatures do change the rules to benefit their particular party, which is unfortunate, details do matter. In America, we do let partisans run the election process, which not every democracy does that. A lot of other countries that we admire for other reasons, like Australia, Britain, where we inherited our legal system from, Canada, try to make election administration much more nonpartisan so that you can't have one team manipulating the rules for its benefit. That has not been our tradition, unfortunately. But the one piece of good news this year is that the courts have really stepped in. When legislatures around the country, like in North Carolina or Texas or Wisconsin, go too far in making it too difficult to vote, federal courts that are not elected officials have stepped in, invoking provisions of federal law, the Constitution itself and the Voting Rights Act, to say, no, that is too burdensome, and there's not an adequate justification on the part of the state legislature. It does look purely partisan and not a fair law. And so this year, really more than any other, we started to see this a couple of years ago, but really this year we've seen the courts step in and protect voting rights. I think it's important to use the term disenfranchisement specifically to mean when a voter is actually disenfranchised. And I certainly never want to see that. And that's why I'm so worried about provisional ballots not being counted when the voter is indeed eligible. And if you trip up a voter because they accidentally put today's date on the form instead of their birth date, but you know it's a valid voter, that's a gotcha. That's not appropriate in a democracy. That voter should not be disenfranchised. But there are occasions where the legislature or the Secretary of State will want to make some adjustments in the voting rules, sometimes to save money, which is a legitimate concern, sometimes for other reasons, that I think ought to be seen. You know, potentially it makes it a little bit less convenient to vote, but that's not disenfranchisement. And so we've had some adjustments here in Ohio.
Like Golden Week being eliminated.
Right. And you can debate that as a matter of policy. But I don't think it's fair to say that voters are disenfranchised as a result of that.
They still
change.
Have the right to vote.
Correct.
Yeah. Golden Week being, of course, the opportunity to both register to vote and vote on the same day.
Yeah.
Right. Which has been eliminated now. And that's been upheld by...
Correct. That I mean, again, there's been torturous litigation over that, like so many things.
Yeah,
but the bottom line is the appellate court sustained the validity of that change that the Ohio legislature made.
Okay, I'm going to turn to Bill in Westerville. Bill, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about. When are the absentee ballots actually counted? Are they counted when they come in? And if so, who has access to that information?
Okay. Yeah. Peg Rosenfield.
They are not counted until the polls close. But they can get them all processed as they come in and through Election Day, but they are not allowed to total them until the polls close, and when you hear results about 8:30 on election night, those are the absentee ballots because they've all been processed ahead of time. And as soon as the polls close, wham, that's when you want to hear some results, and those are the absentees. So okay. They're the first ones counted. Yes, they do count them in every election, and you don't have to worry about they'll be in there.
The ones that aren't counted the day of election are the provisional ballots. Or the
the provisionals have to be looked at by the board members to see, okay, yes, we can count this one, no one. And they start that 10 days after the election. And so the results you see on election night are unofficial. And they may change very slightly 10 days later. The other thing is that election officials tell me the absentees are often not indicative of what the total will be. They may come in much more one-sided
a little bit more on that, if I might.
Well,
Peg is absolutely right about most of the absentee ballots in the state. There are some, a fraction of the absentee ballots get processed a little bit too late to make it into that election night count,
okay.
And that they will end up they all have to be counted in every provisional ballot.
Like overseas ballots and that kind of a thing?
Right. And so they will get counted along with the provisional ballots that are eligible as part of the certification of the election. But one development that's happened here in Ohio and around the country that we were kind of unaware of and were caught by surprise is the degree to which those counts can shift between preliminary returns on election night and then the final certification. And I happened to notice that President Obama in 2012 increased his margin of victory in Ohio, my memory serves now, by around 60,000 votes between election night and final certification. Huh. That's a large shift. This is new territory. It's a result of increased reliance on certain on absentee ballots and on provisional ballots and so forth. So there is at least theoretically the possibility of an election where a candidate on election night is behind by a few thousand votes, but could make up that margin in the certification process. We haven't had that play out that way, but the data suggests that that's a greater possibility than it used to be 15 years ago or so.
Because more people are voting provisionally. More people are taking advantage of that.
Well, more people are more people are voting early, too.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that you – and they're it kind of boils down sometimes to which campaigns got their voters out and urged them to vote early. So you may get a skewed vote early because that campaign was really good at getting their folks out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that the political scientists are looking into because we don't quite understand. The term is overtime or extra innings, the notion that – because we normally think of the election as ending on election day. But in fact – you don't have election results until you have certification.
Right.
It used to be, as Peg said, that the difference between election night results and certified results would be minuscule, so inconsequential. But we're starting to see this increase in a difference, not just in Ohio, but we don't have a full understanding of this. So there's a political scientist at MIT who's very well respected, nonpartisan, has been looking into this. So, stay tuned in terms of the best explanation for it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or you can check out Facebook. Annette writes on Facebook, where can I find an unbiased description of the issues for Franklin County this election? Peg Rosenfield?
Well, you can get statistics from the radio, from television, the Secretary of State.
No, are the issues like descriptions of what the issues are going to be on the ballot for Franklin County. Do you have to go to the Board of Elections? Is that the best place?
Actually, the League of Women Voters Voter Information Guide.
Okay.
It came out in the Dispatch a couple of weeks ago. They're in the libraries now. That's the best place I know to get really pretty good. And the League does, we do our own explanation and pros and cons that are nonpartisan, informational.
Okay.
It's very hard to get really good non-biased information on issues.
And a lot of people are looking for information on judicial candidates.
Yeah. Oh,
and the League
you.
Is partnered with the Bliss Institute and a number of organizations. JudicialVotesCount.org will give you a good rundown of judges that are running.
Yeah. A lot of people don't like to vote on judges because they don't know anything about them.
Right.
And that's why this was set up. JudicialVotesCount.org.
JudicialVotesCount.org. We'll put that on our website again with all the other information that you want or need at WOSU.org/allsides. Nancy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to echo a couple of things and then make an additional comment. Early voting, I've done it several times. I did it on Monday at the location on Morris Road, and just like your guest said earlier, very busy, but I didn't have to wait at all. It was very efficient, lots of volunteers to help you. But I did want to say, too, just what was just commented, for the first time ever, I actually took that insert with me to vote. So the insert that was in the Dispatch recently, I actually stuck it in my purse and took it with me because there's so much talk about the Senate campaign and the presidential campaign, but then you forget COTA is up for a levy. The city's got some renewal issues. But who's the state Board of Education candidate and what do they stand for? And that insert is very helpful, giving background information. My one comment was, though, in regard to skepticism, when I was at the early voting, I was ready to hand over my vote, my photo ID, and they said, oh, we don't need it. We're connected right to the Board of Elections, so we don't need to see your photo ID. And I saw skepticism on the part of the gentleman next to me. So, you know, there is a level of, oh, I don't need it here, but will I need it on the day I vote? And how will it be in Fairfield County as opposed to Franklin? So I do think there's a lot of, at the very least, raised awareness in terms of how the system works.
That's a difference.
Or doesn't work.
That's the difference between if you vote on election day, you have to have some kind of ID. You don't have to have photo ID, but you have to have some kind of ID. If you vote, you're voting in early voting is actually absentee voting, and you only need either the last four digits of your Social Security number or your driver's license number, and that's all.
And that's the case for voting by mail, too. It's the same rules. Yeah. It's basically you fill out an envelope, an application, as though you're voting absentee.
Okay.
And they verify your name, your signature, your social, with what they have in their system. And then once that reconciles, they count those ballots.
It makes it easier, actually, than to vote on Election Day.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Turning to now Ann in Upper Arlington. You're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My question is about taking selfies or having somebody take a picture of me voting. I'm planning to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I'm making history voting for the first woman for president of the United States. And I wanted to take some pictures, but I heard something about it being illegal.
Thoughts? Yep. Concerns? Peg?
I wasn't aware. It's a felony in Ohio. And they're talking about changing the law, but currently it is a felony to take a picture of a voted ballot. Because if I am trying to bribe you to vote a certain way, I want to see your ballot to make sure that you voted the way I paid you to vote. And that's why it's a felony. Now, there's much discussion of this.
We are in the world of selfies now.
Right.
But couldn't you take a selfie of yourself outside the, you know, the place where it says Board of Elections?
Well, yeah, you can. But I think, Ann, you want to show people you actually voted for Hillary Clinton. She's up. Okay.
But it evidently isn't enforced much, but it is illegal.
Peg's concern is a concern that many election law scholars have, including me. There is a debate in the legal community about this between the need to protect the electoral system from vote buying, which does occur and has occurred in the past. This is why we don't get receipts. We get to look at the paper record if we're voting on an electronic machine, but we don't get to take that with us like a bank receipt because you can't show that to somebody who can then pay you $10 for your vote. A selfie is the functional equivalent of a receipt. The First Circuit Court of Appeals involving, I think, New Hampshire just ruled that there's a First Amendment right to do this so that even if in a state has a law like Ohio does, it's going to be superseded by the constitutional, you know, freedom of expression. So there's some turmoil in the law.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We'll continue our conversation about voting rights, voting laws, voting rules and regulations. When we return, if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In less than 2 weeks, millions of American voters will flock to their polling place, cast a ballot in the 2016 election. By then, millions already will have voted by absentee ballot or in states where early voting is permitted. Still, some voters worry about what to expect on November 8th. Donald Trump has fueled those concerns with his warnings of voter fraud and rigged elections. We're talking about how to vote in the 2016 general election. Still with us is elections specialist at the League of Women Voters of Ohio, Peg Rosenfield, also election administration director for the Ohio Voter Rights Coalition, Camille Wimbush, and director of the Election Law Center at the OSU Moritz College of Law, Ned Foley. Ned is also the author of a book. It's entitled Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. He will be gathering to talk about the topic of that book tonight in Bexley.
Bexley Public Library at 7 p.m.
Okay.
Open to the public.
Free and open to the public. So if you want to learn more about the history of election battles, go to the Bexley Library tonight at 7 o'clock. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to turn now to Barry in Bowling Green. You're on the air. Hi, Barry.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I was listening to Mr. Foley remark earlier that the stealing of elections is something that's very rare in America. And if you recall back to when John Kennedy defeated Richard Nixon, it was Chicago, Illinois, which was the state that swung him over, and it was later proven that it was the mob, Sam Giancana, who had delivered the Democrat vote to John F. Kennedy. And even further back than that, Lyndon Baines Johnson's first congressional election was won with a stuffed ballot box. So we've been rigging elections in America since America's been having elections. I haven't read his book, but if he makes a statement that it's a rare occurrence that the elections are stolen in America, I don't know that I really want to read it if it's really objective.
Ned Foley.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those two examples because I do discuss both of them in the book. And I think they are important ones to grapple with. And that's why I'm careful to say that the risk is not zero. And it's important to monitor the process and to do so in a bipartisan way so that each side can feel like the system is transparent and double-checking. You are correct. There have certainly been instances going back to the time of the founding involving rigged elections in the sense of fraud to swing it. There was a congressional election from the state of Georgia in 1792, which had flagrant ballot box stuffing of the kind that you're talking about. So I'm striving for objectivity in the book, but I do think it's fair to say that the frequency, the rate of the number of elections that are tainted by that kind of fraud as a proportion of all elections is low and gets lower and lower. One thing I'd like to say about 1960, because it is a presidential election that's really important to think about, you're right. There were significant problems in the state of Illinois, and most historians believe that the Mayor Daley political machine was stealing some number of votes on behalf of Democrats, including the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. But in order for Nixon to have prevailed over Kennedy in 1960, he would have had to flip the result in both Illinois and Texas. Just overturning fraud in Illinois would not have been enough to win the White House. And my judgment on the real problem from 1960, the real lesson to learn, is that Texas did not have any mechanism for a recount or any process that would have allowed Nixon fairly to get an accurate determination of the result in that state. And he actually mentions this in the memoirs that he wrote in 1962 afterwards. He said, "What's the point of fighting in Illinois? I'd have to win both Illinois and Texas, and I can't win Texas because there's no fair procedure." And again, historians looking back at that, and including myself, say that's an accurate judgment about the inadequacy of Texas procedure at the time. And that's a real blemish on American democracy and on that election. It's always going to have that asterisk next to it, mm-hmm. You couldn't get closure in the proper way because Texas didn't have a good process.
Barry, thanks a lot for that call. Mike now in Columbus. Mike, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you. I saw it reported in our local paper that in order for your absentee ballot to be counted, the signature needed to be in cursive. And I can't find that requirement anywhere else. And it sounds to me like somebody was trying to disenfranchise people who have never used this alphabet before and never signed a document
like
in cursive.
70% of the people under the age of 19 in this country.
Well,
no, that's a good question. But, I mean, what about that?
I don't think it is in the law, but boards of elections in different counties could interpret it different ways. And we would hope maybe the legislature will address that issue.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. I mean, they're supposed to check the signature on the registration card against the signature at the poll book at the or on the absentee ballot envelope. But there's no requirement that it be signed cursive. It just and there are issues with signature matching as a methodology of verification. And they're supposed to apply uniform standards, but a signature is sort of in the eye of the beholder unless you're an expert.
Right.
But that's my understanding is that would be misinformation to say that you have to sign in a particular way.
Okay, Mike. Thanks a lot for that call. Then there's Bruce in Galena. You're on the air. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring up something that I haven't heard anybody talk about, and that is when you vote early by absentee ballot, you get this pre-printed form with some instructions in it from the Secretary of State, and all over it, it talks about you are responsible for the proper postage, and if it doesn't have the proper postage, it may not be delivered, and it's your responsibility to put postage on it. And that's sort of the scary thing. So I took mine to the post office, and guess what? It requires a first-class stamp, that's all. And they tell me that they're delivering stuff regardless of the amount of postage.
That's because a mistake was made. Yeah, Peg Rosenfield?
Yeah, I read it in the newspaper. In Franklin County, they told you it would only take one stamp, and in fact, it took two. But they have arranged with the Postal Service, Franklin County anyway, that they will accept anything and they will pay the difference in the postage because it was their error. I don't know about other counties. The price depends on how many pieces of paper it took. Mm-hmm. And if it's only one, evidently one stamp will do it.
And that varies from county to county.
But if it's two or three pieces of paper, it takes two stamps. But this is just a guess. My guess would be other counties are also paying the postage if they made a mistake. I just don't know if it's two or three pages and they didn't tell you that it only I don't know what they'll do.
Yeah, I think the best advice that we're getting for people who are calling in the hotline is, you know, to put two stamps on it, take it to the post office, get it weighed. If you're at all concerned, a lot of the counties will allow you to actually have secure drop boxes, and you can actually take it back to the county board of elections and drop it in there, and then you don't have to worry about whether it got there in
but
the mail.
For some people, that's a hardship. But glad you brought that up, Bruce. Thanks a lot for that call. Pat in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Yes, hi. I just turned the radio on and heard the question about early voting, and it was described as absentee. But what about the in-person early voting that's going on right now on Morris Road? I understand that you have to have an ID in order to vote.
No, not at early voting. Early voting is absentee voting.
And it's at the Board of Elections.
It's at the Board of Elections.
That's the thing.
And you only need the last four digits of your Social Security number or your driver's license number. You don't need to show the driver's license. Okay. Either one.
But that's absolutely true. But this, I understand why Pat's confused. Because when you go to Morse Road, it feels like in-person voting because you're going there. It doesn't feel like absentee voting, but technically under the law, it is. My advice would be if you have an ID, bring it with you. There's no harm in having it with you. They're not supposed to ask you for it, but You know, one thing that we tell our law students is there's a difference between the law in the books and the law that gets enforced on the ground. And so if you have a poll worker that's trying his best, her best, but they're just a little bit mistaken, you don't want to lose your right to vote because of that. So so an extra measure of precaution, maybe, if you can. I mean, obviously, some people, if they don't have the ID, right, they should stick to their rights. But if it's not a hardship for you, bring it with you anyway.
Okay, Pat, let's see. I'm going to turn to Gail now in Columbus. Hi, Gail, you're on the air.
I'm on the air. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
This has to do with the number of days, all the number of days a person can vote as the system's set up now. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, have you found or do you think that this leads to procrastination? Because I have heard that the actual percentage or number of votes, voters, doesn't really increase, that over time they found that it really makes very little difference in how many people actually vote. And so if you just put it off, but it doesn't really increase your, you know, getting to the polls, I don't see that it really helps a whole lot. And okay, along that same line, mm-hmm, I also think that when we are pressed by one party or the other to vote early, or even to make it easier for the board, mm-hmm, that actually you never know what's going to happen a week or two before the election. And those votes then, you know, are locked in. You could change your mind and it's too late.
Okay. Thoughts about whether it's worth it? What do we know?
Interesting thoughts.
Yeah. I'm involved in a project that's tried to study this, and the caller is absolutely right. You have to balance some competing considerations. If you have a month or 6 weeks of early voting and people take advantage of that at the very beginning, that's before some of the presidential debates occur or and other information that could affect it. Now, what people say on the other side is, well, the very first voters are likely the most locked-in partisans who are less likely to change their minds. So they're just doing it to get it out of the way and move on. So you can kind of see both sides to that. I would say the one important finding in terms of making the system work better is what it can do is distribute the volume of voters across the number of poll workers and machines that have to handle it. So we in Ohio in 2004, many people may remember, had horrific long lines, sometimes 7 hours in some places, because there was just that unbelievable demand to vote that day. Even if you're not increasing turnout, if you're distributing it over, say, 2 weeks or 3 weeks, okay, it's easier for the system to handle.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, also the convenience factor is important for some people, certain segments of the society. I worry sometimes about, well, I know a lot of people in the medical field who work 12-hour shifts.
Yeah.
And who work Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Who they need to be able to go do it when they have time. And there are a lot of people who work strange hours and things, and we really need, I think, making it convenient is a legitimate reason for helping people vote.
Email from Mike. Gail, by the way, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Email from Mike. Where can a person find the rules for poll watchers, such as are they allowed to carry guns and how close can they stand to you?
That's a good question. The election protection hotline, you can call in if you have any questions or you feel like there's anything that's intimidating or something that's happening at their polling places that's making you feel unsafe. We are organizing volunteers on election day that'll primarily be in urban counties who'll be at polling places to help voters with voter questions or to call in issues such as, you know, someone with a gun, as you mentioned, in the unfortunate instance if that were to happen. But in order to be inside the polling places, you have to actually have a certificate from a political party or a candidate to actually get you inside the polling place. So that means you can't just walk up on election day. Any person can just walk up and assert their right to be inside the poll and to see what's going on.
Observers are official. They're not just casual.
Correct. They have to be credentialed by the Board of Elections.
And they can't carry a gun.
And that's not just inside the polling place. That's within 100 feet
right
of
the door.
Yeah, and there's a buffer zone. There's 100. You have to be 100 feet feet from the polling place. So the voters could not be sort of harassed or intimidated or felt any electioneering or campaigning could not go on. So people have to respect the lines and the flags. And if you want to be at your polling location just to see what's happening, as our volunteers will be doing to help voters, you won't have to be back behind the lines.
We are out of time. I'm so glad you guys were able to join us today.
Can I just put in the plug on Election Day? The League of Women Voters will have a phone bank at Channel 10. They'll run the number across, and you can call anything you want.
With any kind of questions or concerns. Yep. Okay. And we'll get the other number from Camille Wimbush's organization. Camille Wimbush, Election Administration Director for Ohio Voice.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Also, Peg Rosenfield, Election Specialist at League of Women Voters. Thanks for joining us today, Peg. And Ned Foley, Professor and the Director of the Election Law Center at the Morris College of Law at OSU. Thanks to you as well. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.